Senator Eaton's bill. This is Senate File 1603, and Mr. Backus has got some language to propose that we think will address the concerns we were discussing before we recessed. Mr. Backus?
Mr. Chair and members, the proposal is to delete Subdivision 3, which is the gross misdemeanor offense, and then to work with the Subdivision 2 felony offense. And
excuse me, Mr. Backus, Mr. Chair. Subdivision 3 on the bill or the amendment?
On the bill.
Okay, thank you.
So then working on, beginning on line 2.7 of the bill, the words or knowingly have already been deleted, but we would now delete intentionally. So it would just read a person who sells, purchases, etc. And then on line 2.9, after device, insert knowing that the device or phantomware is capable of being used to commit tax fraud or suppress sales. And then we would delete subdivision 3, renumber the two remaining subdivisions, and on line 2.18, delete or 3, so that it would be a 5-year felony for a person who does any of those things, sells, purchases, uses, etc., only if they know that the device or phantomware is capable of being used to commit tax fraud or suppress sales.
Mr. Backus, do we need to define suppress sales? We have a definition for automated sales suppression device. Is that, would that be enough to cover it?
Mr. Chair, I think they would look at that. I'm not sure that you need to define it beyond that.
All right. Department of Revenue, what do you think?
Mr. Chair.
Cummings.
Members of the committee, we think that this is a good solution to thread the needle here. Mr. Chair, is it your intention then to remove Subdivision 3?
Yes. And renumber Subdivisions 4 and 5.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Does that work?
Yes. Thank you.
Mr. Cummings.
So moved.
Senator Eaton, I wish you could, but you can't.
So moved.
Senator Dietzick moves the amendment as described by Mr. Backus. Any further clarification or discussion needed for the amendment? All those in favor of adopting the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify in connection with this bill? Any further discussion on Senate File 1603?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, there was, I don't know if we've done a whole lot of talk about 5-year felony or not. I don't know if this is, this could affect a bed cost in our fiscal notes. I know there are 3-year felonies, there's 10-year felonies, but we haven't really talked about proportionality of the felony charge. And I'm at least wanting to at least have a discussion about that for a mere possession. I'm not sure if that's an appropriate sentence or not.
Mr. Cummings, Ms. Reisdorf, how does this compare to other tax fraud or tax evasion felonies in terms of penalties?
Senator Latz, members of the committee, Senator Limmer, the 5-year penalty and the five-year $5,000 that was in the original draft, which has now been amended to $10,000, the 5 years mirrors other states. We have about 20 states that have similar penalties for this type of behavior, and most of them have 5 or more years. And so it was just simply in an effort to be consistent with sort of the model language that was developed at NCSL, and that's the reason for the 5-year.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer,
this is a this would be considered more of a property crime, a personal crime, non-personal crime, and if you're comparing the rest of the states, they generally do not have as strict a incarceration rate as the state of Minnesota has historically done, and now we're relying on a national organization telling us that the sentences nationwide are what you see in this document. I think it's important for us to have a discussion about that. I haven't seen a fiscal note on it, but 5 year, I don't know how many people get involved in this type of a crime that would impact a prison budget. Mr. Turner, would you have any?
Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz and members, I have requested a fiscal note, but it seems to me that the conviction and the felony isn't the point here, unless I'm getting it wrong. It's the liability for the stolen tax receipts.
Oh.
So I don't know. And, of course, in our system, this would probably be a low level. It'd be rated low on the sentencing guidelines grid. I expect the fiscal note to come back, minimal impact on the vets. I don't see them. I don't see people going to prison on this. But then, of course, I'm not the sentencing guidelines woman. So there is a note requested. We can send it to finance if you'd like. Although, as I've been listening, I think it's getting people on the hook for the liabilities of the bill. And so what they need is a conviction more than a 5-year felony or a 3-year felony. But that's my take.
You know, last case I read about where you had someone who embezzled like $300,000 from an employer, if I recall, the sentence was like a year and a half in prison. So if you get a high enough, if you've got the restaurant owner, for example, that's doing this, and the numbers get up high enough, I mean, you know, that was in federal court. How that'll fall in state court, who knows? But there'll be room for some proportionality in there in the sentencing process. And you know, with some experience, if it's determined it's not enough or it's too much, you know, I'm sure we can hear back. But if you've got a business owner who's doing this, and they get $1 million, you know, maybe we'll find 5 years isn't enough to be able to sufficiently deter that activity.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer,
to have up to a 5-year felony for intentionally possessing, just possessing this instrument, I guess I find that I try to be very cautious when I talk about felonies, because politically, once you put a mark on a felony and raise it to a certain mark, it's almost politically impossible to lessen it. Just been our experience, and so I'm glad we had the discussion. I'll go wherever the committee is, but I just thought that maybe it would be at least important to broach the subject in committee.
Appreciate you bringing it up, Senator Limmer. I mean, certainly there's a certain amount of prosecutorial discretion we'll have to rely on. If all that can be demonstrated is possession and there hasn't been any demonstrated use, I suspect you'll have the case treated differently. You might get a stay of adjudication. You might get a stay of imposition with a reduction to a gross misdemeanor or misdemeanor at the end of the stay. So there are a number of different ways to handle that depending on the perceived culpability of the violator. I mean, you're right, I think, to raise the question. We want to fashion the best that we can. But there being absolutely no lawful purpose to possess this software, but tax evasion, to me that strikes it as a little different animal. Senator Hall?
It reminds me of, I don't know where the law is now, but the radar detector for cars, and there's no good reason for it, but it was illegal, I think, to possess, but illegal to use, if I remember right. I'm not sure where that is now.
That might still be the case. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's kind of strange.
Haven't needed to look into that. All right, is there any further discussion on Senate File 1603? Seeing none, Senator Dietzick, moves that Senate File 1603 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much for the thoughtful discussion. Appreciate it.
All right, we're going to move to Senator Dedzic's. Revenue is still here. We're going to take care of revenue issues. Senator Dedzic. Senate File 1192, Senator Dedzic.
Thank you. Good evening, Mr. Chair and members. We're hearing Senate File 1192. This bill addresses issues relating to...
Good evening.
That's not good evening. It's been a long day.
Natasha.
This bill addresses...
Welcome to the Judiciary Committee.
It's getting late, isn't it? Yes. Yeah.
Well, by the way, I've got not really Oreos back here,
ooh,
cookies. So see, any members of the committee that wish to help yourself, feel free.
We all run up here.
Mr. Chair and members, this bill addresses issues relating to tobacco tax avoidance. Members, the bill was originally drafted, established a new state retail license for selling tobacco with additional fees. The retail establishments already need to be licensed by county or other local governments to sell tobacco, so the Department of Revenue decided to work off of that system and not create an additional bureaucracy. I have an author's delete-all bill, I believe it's the A15 amendment, that reflects those changes and some additional fine-tuning that really focus on the bad actors. The bill creates civil penalties for failure to comply and also creates a process for revoking a cigarette and tobacco retail license with notice and due process procedures similar to those used when someone attempts to evade paying other taxes. It establishes a process to obtain new license after revocation. The Revenue Department currently has authority to publish a list of delinquent taxpayers, and this bill allows them to publish the list of revoked retail tobacco product license with prior notice. Similar to some other financial or other crimes, a person may sell a small amount in multiple locations that may be across county lines, but if you add them all up, it becomes a larger amount. So this bill allows any prosecution of unstamped or untaxed tobacco products sold or purchased in violation of law within a six-month period to be aggregated. The bill also adds a felony charge for willful failure to pay cigarette and tobacco taxes. This felony charge aligns with the tax provisions for income, corporate, and sales and use taxes so that similar offenses are dealt with in a similar manner. Members, I've had conversations about the bill with many interested parties. I think they had some concerns initially, but believe it is now moving in the right direction. There are two oral amendments that I will make as we go through the bill. One is dealing with an issue brought to us, our attention on the County Attorneys Association, and another is raising one of the penalties. With me today is Mr. Paul Cummings, Tax Policy Manager with the Department of Revenue, to give a brief overview, and then Mr. Mark Peterson, an attorney with the department, will walk us through the bill. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Cummings.
So before we do that, let's adopt, this is the first stop.
Yes.
Policy consideration. So we have the author's amendment. Members, in your packet, the A15-0270 amendment is the author's amendment. Senator Dedzic moves its adoption. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Members, sections 11 and 12 are the two sections specifically within this committee's consideration. This bill will be going to finance from here. So we're the only policy committee that's going to hear this. HHS waived jurisdiction and taxes waived jurisdiction. So why don't we get a summary of the entire bill, but then we'll make sure we focus in on the provisions that are most concerned about here. Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. Mr. Chair, for the last 5 years, the department has observed an increase in smuggling and the sale of untaxed tobacco products. This smuggling creates an unfair and illegal advantage over compliant retailers and distributors. This proposal aims at leveling the playing field for retailers. In 2012, a little over 2% of all retail inspections led to a seizure of untaxed tobacco products. That number rose to over 17% in 2014. Mr. Chair, you'll find that there are three large components of this proposal. The first is trying to create a dedicated set of a unit at the Department of Revenue in order to really focus on this effort to stop tobacco smuggling that will be discussed in the State Government Finance Committee. Second, as Senator Dietzick talked about, it's providing the Department of Revenue with the ability to suspend and revoke a local license if a taxpayer is found to be noncompliant. And then finally, this bill would institute civil and criminal penalties for noncompliance with tobacco laws, which Senator Dietzick ably went over. I think with that, Chair, I would like to turn it over to our attorney, Mr. Mark Peterson, to outline the bill as drafted. I also wanted to note, Mr. Chair, in terms of the process for the seizure of untaxed tobacco products and how that due process happens and then moving to revocation, I could testify to all the various steps that that would go through, and Mr. Peterson will touch on them as he walks through the bill. But if that would be helpful after his testimony in a more succinct manner, we can do that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Peterson. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue, and I'm going to just go section by section through the bill so you understand what we're trying to accomplish here. Section 1 is simply a purpose statement that I think Mr. Cummings already has addressed. Section 2 repeals a cross-reference to a provision that we proposed to repeal in the repealer section. It allowed the Commissioner of Revenue to repeal the sales tax permit of a taxpayer who violates the cigarette tax laws. This was passed in 2001. It was a law that we've never used. And while geared towards the same kind of enforcement action that we're seeking in this bill, it really became ineffective in 2005 when the imposition of the sales tax was removed from the retail level to the distributor level to pay as the cost of a cigarette stamp. The result would be if we tried to revoke a sales tax permit right now for somebody who was violating a cigarette tax law, they would still be allowed to sell cigarettes because they don't need to have a sales tax permit to be able to make the cigarette sales. So we're going to repeal that. This is a cross-reference. Section 3 allows the commissioner to publish a list of businesses, including the officers of businesses, who've had their local cigarette and tobacco licenses revoked for being in possession of contraband. Modeled after existing authority that we have for posting names of delinquent taxpayers, these names are only going to get posted after the commissioner sees product as contraband, taxpayer has exercised or decide not to exercise rights to a judicial determination on the question of the seizure. The commissioners then notified the taxpayer of the intent to have the license revoked. The taxpayer then has exercised or not exercised a right to challenge that license revocation before a OAH hearing. And then the taxpayer receives notice from the commissioner of intent to publish their name. The names would stay on this list for 5 years or until the taxpayer receives a clearance to get a new license, and I'll discuss that process a little bit later. Section 4 is simply a technical correction helping to define the definition of a retailer. Sections 5 and 6 increase the fees that we currently impose on distributors of cigarettes and distributors and subjobbers, increasing the license for cigarette fees from $300 to $500 and for subjobbers from $24 to $100. For tobacco product license, changing it from $75 to $500 and for subjobbers from $20 to $50. We had told Senator Dietzig yesterday that those
sorry,
hadn't
Mr.
been...
Mr. Peterson, I'm missing something here. Say Section 5? Oh, I'm sorry, you jumped to Section 6 as well.
Yes, Mr. Okay. Chairman, I'm sorry. They sort of run together. We had told Senator Dietzig yesterday that those had not been changed since about 1990, which is true, but in 1990 they actually were doubled to reflect a two-year license period earlier had been 1 year. Actually, they haven't really been changed since Legislative Act of 1969. Section 7 allows the commissioner to refuse to renew or refuse to issue a new license to a distributor or subjobber who has previously violated cigarette and tobacco laws or any other law related to cigarette and tobacco. Commissioner already has the authority to revoke an existing license. This kind of closes a gap in other situations. Section 8 amends a law that requires retailers and subjobbers to retain purchase invoices by requiring that they be kept on site or available for 1 hour upon request of the commissioner. They have to keep these for at least 1 year or as long as the product is maintained in inventory. Current law simply requires they be kept for 1 year. That provision is effective for product that they purchase after July 1 of this year. Section 9 is the revocation of the local cigarette and tobacco license. Under current law, all retail sellers of cigarette and tobacco products must be licensed at the local level. This section allows the commissioner to revoke those locally issued cigarette and tobacco licenses if the license holder has been in possession of contraband. So again, this only happens after the retailer has been found in possession of contraband as defined in 297F21, which would be unstamped cigarettes, untaxed tobacco products, or a product for which they've not been able to produce the invoice upon request of the commissioner. And then it would be after the retailers exercise their rights to the judicial determination that I mentioned earlier, which is they have 60 days to go to district court to challenge the seizure. And if it's less than $10,000 of value of property, they have the right to go to conciliation court to challenge that seizure. Then the bill, that's under existing law, that right to challenge the seizure, and we're not changing it in this bill. After the seizure determination is decided by the courts, the commissioner then can notify the licensee of the intent to revoke the local license. And this is new language.
Peterson, can you point us to exactly where you are?
Mr. Chairman, I'm on Section 9 of the amendment. I'm about ready to start explaining Subdivision 3 at 6.7.
Thank you.
This language is modeled, Mr. Chairman, after language that we already have in existing law for the revocation of licenses for taxpayers who owe delinquent taxes. We have the authority to revoke licenses, state or locally issued licenses, and the taxpayers can get back upon paying of the tax or coming into a payment agreement. What happens is the taxpayer, in this case the licensee, will be notified by the commissioner of the right to, that we're planning on revoking the local license. They will then have 30 days if they want to challenge that by going to the OAH hearing. At the end of that hearing, assuming that the license clearance has been deemed acceptable, the department then will notify the local authority, licensing authority, of the revocation under proposal and under existing law for the other kinds of license revocations. The local licensing authority has 10 days to notify the license holder that we're going to revoke your license, and then 30 days to actually revoke the license. Now, the revocation will only apply at the location where the contraband was found. It's not going to directly affect other locations where the licensee might have a license, either in that community or in any other community. However, a license holder or an officer of a license holder who's had a revocation is going to have consequences. They're going to need to go through a license clearance process before they can get any new licenses or before they can get the revoked license renewed. And to get the license clearance, we've used language that exists mainly from our current authority to revoke sales tax permits. The license holder and the applicant officers will need to sign a statement agreeing to comply with cigarette and tobacco tax laws. They will need to pay sales tax. They'll need to agree to pay sales tax on the tobacco products they sell in the future, and they need to post bond or security equal to 10 times the tax on the contraband. The department will hold that security for 2 years. Interest will be paid at the rate the department charges on unpaid tax, and which is the same rate the department pays on interest on refunds owed. The department will be able to apply that to any unpaid taxes that the licensee might have in the future, or to any taxes on contraband product found after the license clearance. The commissioner can refuse to issue the license clearance if the license holders had two licenses revoked in a five-year period, or if officers of that of the applicant of a licensee have had been the officers of two license holders whose license have been revoked during a five-year period. Section 10 creates new civil penalties on retailers and subjobbers who don't have required invoices or are in possession of contraband or make sales without license. Penalty is $1,000 for the first offense, $2,000 for the second offense, and $5,000 for each offense, each subsequent offense in a given 36-month period. A retailer in possession of untaxed product will be subject to a penalty of the greater of $2,000 or 150% of the tax due on the untaxed product. This is effective for violations occurring after June 30 of 2015. These penalties will be assessed on orders of assessment the commissioner has under existing authority. Those notices are required to explain the appeal rights that taxpayers will have, which will be both an administrative appeal to have it reviewed by the commissioner and a right to go directly to tax court. Those administrative appeals, if they take that route, they then get additional rights if they want to challenge those penalties in tax court. Section 11 establishes felonies for willfully attempting to evade 297F taxes by failing to file a return and for willfully attempting to evade a tax by failing to pay it when required. Section 12 allows the number of unstamped cigarettes or the value of untaxed product purchased during any six-month period to be aggregated in charging a defendant. There are at least two different criminal penalties that misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, or felony, depending on the quantity of the cigarettes or tobacco product that is found, and this allows those to be aggregated during six-month period.
Mr. Peterson, a question for you, Senator Hall.
Mr. Peterson, what's stamped or unstamped cigarettes? I don't know what that means.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator Hall. Stamped cigarettes. Is an indication that the tax is paid. Distributors are required to put a little state cigarette stamp right on the product to show that it's been paid. That's a stamp. It's a state-issued stamp that costs whatever the price of the tax is on the cigarettes, and they fix it right onto the package. So that would be the tax. The untaxed, unstamped would be...
Yeah. Mr. Chair, in our test fair, is that on the package? Is it on the box or cart or where? I mean, every package of cigarettes has a stamp on it?
Mr. Chair, oh. Senator Hall, yeah, okay. It's right on each
Mr.
stamp.
Mr. Peterson.
Yes, yeah, on
Thank
each,
you.
Each pack.
Sorry, I didn't
know. This provision will, this section, Mr. Chair, also provides that when two or more crimes are committed by the same individual in two or more counties, the accused can be prosecuted in either county. Section 13 amends the definition of contraband in two ways. The first is that it clarifies that contraband includes cigarette and tobacco products for which the retailer or subjobber does not produce an itemized invoice within 1 hour after being requested by the commissioner. The law currently requires the retailers to have that invoice and to produce it within the 1 hour. This clarifies that the product remains contraband if they don't produce it within the 1 hour. Second,
Mr. Peterson, one moment. Senator Lemon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, tell me about the 1 hour notice. Are retailers, do they have an invoice list that's readily available within 1 hour?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limerick, that's current law. We double and triple checked that yesterday. They didn't get into more, but that is actually current law that they are supposed to have it, and they're supposed to have it on site. Because we had the discussion on, well, what if there's multiple stores? Literally, if you have a store in Moorhead and you've got a store in Detroit Lakes, you can't get there in an hour. And so, but the current law is that you have to have that invoice in each location.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dietzick, if we could go back to Section 12.
Yes.
Line 7.25.
That last sentence, Mr. Chair, that is the one where I believe it may or may not be in violation of Rule 24, and so that was my amendment. One of my amendments at the end would be to remove that in the alternative. Prosecution under the section be brought in Ramsey County would be deleted.
So, Mr. Chair, that was deleted in while I was out of the room?
No.
No, we were going to, I had two oral amendments, and so that was going to be one we were going to discuss when he was done, if that was your question, or...
That's Senator. Mr. Chair, that is where I was headed. I withdraw my question.
All right.
We can do it now if you want.
Sure, let's do it now. Well,
all right.
Well, we know.
I move that we delete the last sentence in Subdivision 13, and it is potentially in violation of Criminal Procedures Rule 24. Moving it.
Okay.
Department of Revenue is located in Ramsey County, and so if you don't pay your taxes and
Senator Dietzick, can you pull the microphone forward, please?
The thought for this was that the Department of Revenue is located in Ramsey County, so if people don't file their taxes or don't submit the taxes, that the crime could be taking place in Ramsey County. So that was kind of the thought. There was some question on if that works or not. So we're that was one of my oral amendments was just to delete that line. So I mean. Move we delete the last sentence in Division 13.
Senator Dietzick, how are current tax fraud or tax evasion cases handled in terms of venue? Is Ramsey County available?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Peterson.
My understanding is a lot of times it is because the tax returns get filed with the Department of Revenue, and that is sufficient connection to have a lot of the crimes prosecuted in St. Paul.
Okay. So this language would either be superfluous or confusing, but better not to be in the bill?
Mr. Chair, probably yes.
All right. Yes. So Senator Dietzick moves on line 7.25 to delete everything after the period and to delete line 26. Any further questions or discussion on that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Mr. Peterson, go ahead.
Section 13 also defines contraband to include all product in the possession of an unlicensed retailer, including product for which the tax has already been paid. Section 14 amends the existing law that requires local government units to notify the commissioner of local cigarette and tobacco licenses by requiring the information to also include the business identification number of the licensee in the name of individuals who will be purchasing cigarette and tobacco products for the licensee. We envision this as being an attachment to the local license. It's effective for licenses issued or renewed after December 31 of 2015 to give the locals a little time to do that, to coincide with the annual licensing that's usually what happens.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you could go back to line 9.8, and explain, if you would, please, that in a little bit more detail. Well, we're talking about cigarettes and tobacco products for which the tax has been paid. Is the violation there because the retailer doesn't have a license under this newly created license?
Mr. Peterson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman. Yes, I mean it's somebody who's mainly had their license revoked, and they continue to operate in total disregard of the fact that their license has been revoked.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Newman,
as long as we're on the license, if I could inquire, what's the current law regarding licenses to sell cigarettes? I'm assuming it is not a license at the state level, maybe issued at the municipal level or something, if you could respond, Senator Deasick?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. And so it is, there is, they literally have applications and they're, I mean, the revenue has like a form that the counties can use or create their own. And then the counties or the local municipality has ordinances that handle it. And so is what we are doing so that the revenue can kind of get an idea of who is out there that has been authorized to sell these products. We are piggybacking onto that that system that's already set up. So we're not we're trying not to add an additional layer of bureaucracy where the state does their own licensing. We're piggybacking on. And so I don't know if you have additional.
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, part of the original proposal was to create a statewide retail license. And when we had talked to the retailers and the petroleum marketers and some of the other people who would be selling, they thought that those two levels is too much for them in terms of paperwork, in terms of fees, in terms of other things. So this is really an attempt to try and make sure that we're creating the best possible way to meet the outcomes to do this while trying to think through the needs of the petroleum marketers and the retailers and others who are partners in collecting these taxes.
I'm sorry, Mr. Senator Chairman. I'm still confused. Is this bill creating a statewide license to sell tobacco?
No.
Or is it or are the licenses remaining at the local level?
Mr. Cummings, who will issue these licenses?
There will be one license. That license authority already exists. It is for under the counties right now. And so this is just going to allow the department with a number of levels of due process the ability to revoke that local license if taxes are not being paid or they're selling untaxed product. So we are not creating a new license. There is only one license, and that is under current law. And so we are just adding the ability for the state, if retailers are selling untaxed product, to be able to revoke that existing current local license.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're creating the enforcement mechanism. With the existing licensing scheme.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Does that work for you, Senator Newman? Sound like a smart thing to do?
Probably not, but we can keep going. I'm just trying to play catch up here a little bit.
Mr. Chairman,
I apologize for the delay.
No problem at all. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While we're catching up, on page 3, 311 and 331, what's a sub-jobber?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hall, a distributor is generally somebody who gets product from outside the state and brings it in, and on cigarettes, they're the ones who actually put the stamps on the cigarettes. A sub-jobber, and usually they sell directly to the retailers, but sometimes there's a middleman who just buys the stamped product and sells it to the retailer. Sub-jobber.
Okay, it's a common term, Senator, that we don't have to have a definition for?
Mr. Okay, Chairman, Senator Hall, it's defined in 297F in tobacco chapters.
Okay, so thank you.
Mr. Peterson, how is it enforced now?
He stole my question.
I'm channeling Senator Newman here. And if they're not paying their taxes, how is it enforced now if there's no state enforcement mechanism that you're creating here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are retail inspections that currently go on. And if there are retail inspections, they're able to go into the retail location. Then they're able to ask to see receipts. Now, in the case of cigarettes, you're able to look at the cigarette to see if there's a stamp. But in the case of tobacco, it's very difficult to stamp those products. So therefore, those are typically not stamped. So they're asked to have receipts on location that they will be able to submit. They're able to look through those receipts. If there is no substantiation of tax paid and if tax is not paid, then that product is seized. Currently, Mr. Chair...
But Mr. Cummings, who is doing that now? What are you creating here that's different than what's currently being done to enforce it?
After the seizure happens, and they're able to go to district court to challenge that, Mr. Chair, and after that has been fully determined, what we're doing then is now we're saying after that process happens, we would have the ability to start to revoke that local license. Whereas right now, we could only seize untaxed product, and then they could just start doing it again. But right now, we're saying we need to be able to shut that down, because what they're doing is they're just going through, and they, even after selling untaxed product, they just continue to sell untaxed product. So we're looking for a mechanism to be able to stop this behavior in the state, to shut these people who are not paying their taxes down. And then there would be an ability to have that license cleared so that they could come back and begin to sell tobacco again. But right now we don't have that ability. We only have the ability to seize the contraband, Mr. Chair.
So the local, or whoever enforces it now and investigates now, will continue to do that. They'll identify retailers that are not paying their taxes or selling unstamped products. And that enforcement process will proceed as it does now. And then once that's done, they get through the court system, then you can take licensing action, and that's what you're seeking in this bill?
Mr. Chair, the local licenses are primarily given away at the local level in order to stop the sale of tobacco to youth and other health-related purposes. We are the ones who would go in and check and see if there's untaxed product on shelves. That is something we currently do. But right now, if we are seizing product, we can try and work with or coordinate with the local county board in order to have, or a city, in order to have that local license pulled or revoked. But sometimes that doesn't work, or they're not responsive, or they're not that interested. So we still are the ones who go in and seize, look for tax product. We would do the seizure, and now we would have the ability to revoke that local license if there was untaxed product and that was deemed.
All right, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummins, I would assume that at the local level, local law enforcement would be involved with a retailer illegally selling to a minor. Am I correct on that?
That's right, Mr. Chair. Cummins.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Newman.
I'm sorry, what, Senator Newman.
And what you are also then trying to address in this bill is the sale of tobacco products where, you know, the proper tax hasn't been affixed. And so my question is, instead of creating this new system under the where the department is able to take action, what would be wrong with us simply addressing the criminal act of selling to a minor, addressing it as a criminal act to sell untaxed tobacco products, and instead of creating this new scheme, just let local law enforcement take care of it?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, in terms of the sale of tobacco to youth, that is something that has been, delegated, or the state does work with local units of government in order to have that. But in terms of the collection of tobacco taxes, that is not something that we expect our local units of government to do. Obviously, the counties are the people who try and manage our property tax system, but we don't expect the counties to be able to go in and try and see if there is untaxed tobacco product, or we don't expect them to go in and seize untaxed tobacco products.
Senator,
so that's not a local
function. Mr. Chair, Mr. Cummins, but that's really not what I'm talking about. What, What I'm talking about is you said that we, and I assume you're talking about the department, goes in and you check for unpaid tax on tobacco products. What would be wrong with you then, the department, going to local law enforcement and say, hey, these people are breaking the law, and having the local law enforcement investigate that criminal activity, and the department can, by itself, without the county being involved, you take whatever is action is necessary that you feel is appropriate in order to collect your tax, but just bypass this new system that you are setting up, where the department is going to be in control of licensing and revoking and suspending licenses. It seems cumbersome to me and unnecessary.
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, in order to try and create the type of ability for us to have a consistent set of records, and then also for us to be able to go anywhere from, you know, seizing, doing penalties, and then revoking their ability to sell, much like we would for the sales tax. You know, our original thought in terms of as we created our first bill was to have a statewide retail license, so that as we go in to do what we're trying to do, we would have the ability to revoke that license. In our effort to try and hear the concerns of business groups, they were saying we want to deal with one license scheme, and if you wanted to have an ability to revoke that license because you're not paying taxes, we would prefer that to be the mechanism to do that for the retailers who are not playing by the rules, rather than you creating another process so that there are two separate licenses that each retailer must have. So we were trying to, while this may not be perfect, Senator Newman, we were trying to come together with business groups to create a solution that tries to solve the problem but does not have two sets of cumbersome, you know, bureaucratic licenses on top of one another for businesses. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think at this point, then, what I'll just sit back and wait and see if business groups come in and testify in favor of the bill. We'll just see what happens. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Deason.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Newman, I'm actually intrigued with that idea. Some of the reasons that they did the whole civil process and then moving into there is a penalty for failure to pay where we do create a felony, but it all kind of follows what they do for other taxes, be it sales and use tax, income tax, and other tax. So it kind of, the whole process is laid out the way that does, including the felony here. And so I'm intrigued with your idea, but I think there is the process. And we have worked with the retailers, the wholesalers, the petroleum groups. We have worked with groups. I don't know if they thought or what they would think of the just going in and having it go right to a criminal court. But, I mean, the process is kind of laid out because we followed what we did in other sections of tax law.
Senator Lemmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to bring us to another number of subjects. The first one is the effective dates on different sections found in the bill. Some are as soon as June 30th of this year. We may not be done until 3 weeks before that, or...
Don't say it.
Okay, 6 weeks before that. But usually when we're talking of people that might be breaking the law, public notice is important, that the public knows before they get clipped. Also, we're also talking about revoking someone's license, and I think there should be adequate public notice before we impose restrictions. Is there any reason why we have these particular dates?
I think, Mr. Chair, it's all for, Senator Limmer, it's all for the June 30th dates. It's all for sales and purchases made after June 30th. Or for offenses committed after June 30th, and so it's, I get what you're saying, but it's all for after. We could move that out if needed. The, there is a difference on the December date is to line up with licensing with the local government, but I'm comfortable if we want to move it out to, you know, August 1st.
Mr. Chair, usually the dates that we use as effective dates for most of this, not the end of the year reports, but is usually August 1st.
I'm comfortable with that.
All right. Mr. Chair, I would move that. I don't know how many. There's a lot of them in here.
Well, there's a few that the section goes effective, Mr. Chair, July 1st, and then there's a few for that are for the purchases after the 30th, after June 30th. So I don't know if you want both of them, all of them just moved out till, you know, change all of the dates that are in June or July to the August date, or...
Chair, I'm not sure if I know either.
If we could take those provisions and just say either they're, you know, if we, usually we say on or after August 1, which is the same as saying after June 30th, but sort of the on or after August, yeah, or July 30th, the first thing. So,
I think, though, Mr. Chair, though, I think, though, for the, there's one that's for, like, sales after a certain date, because if they have something for prior to, but I'm not seeing that. I don't think it is. I think they're all.
Sales and purchases by subjobbers on page 3 at the bottom of section 8. Is that the one you're referring to?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I would move on line 332, so make that after August 1st.
How about if I suggested this, that Mr. Backus suggested to me, that all the June 30th dates become on or after August 1, 2015, and all of the immediate effective dates or delayed effective dates retain their existing language?
That I would make that motion.
Work. All right. So Senator Dietzick makes that motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Senator Lemmer, did you have some other issues?
Mr. Chair, if I could bring the committee's attention to page 6, line 17. This is in regards to notice and hearing if the commissioner is considering revoking a license or in the path of moving to revoke a license, there must be a public or a notice given to that individual who owns that business. And on line 17, I'm just wondering, it says the notice may be served personally or by mail. My question would be, is mail, U.S. mail, is that a reliable enough method to give public notice? Or perhaps certified mail certainly would be better, and that way that individual would definitely know that there's mail being directed to revoke his livelihood.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lemmer, as to the certified mail, our experience has been that people don't accept the certified mail, so that it actually ends up being less effective than actual regular mail. I mean, we thought about that issue, and it was a conscious decision not to do it as by certified mail for that reason. We've tried it in other areas, and that's what happens.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator,
how would you know that an individual receives your message through the mail? That you're going to revoke their license. Well,
for what it's worth, Senator Lemmer, standard civil litigation also provides under the civil rules of procedure for service by U.S. mail.
Is that right?
Yeah. And it's, but, I mean, it needs to be acknowledged. or there's some, well, if it's a government that's serving it, it can be served to their last known address. It's on record with the agency, and then it's presumed received.
Mr. Chair, we've had that discussion in years ago when government was going to either change the zoning of a particular person's property, and it was used to be relied on that the local newspaper would give that public notice. But if you didn't receive the newspaper and read the fine print in the back of the newspaper, you'd never know that the government's changing its zoning on your property. And in a number of years having that long discussion, we thought that a more positive direction would be to give public notice in certified mail. And that way, when it comes to a government changing the value of a property by zoning or the use, and in this particular case, you're giving a notice to revoke a license, that becomes a little bit more serious than just a simple court hearing. And so I personally like a more positive effort of giving notice when it comes to something of that stature.
Mr. Chairman, to Senator Limmer's point, we could consider requiring posting in the event of a retail establishment, sort of like we could do on mortgage foreclosures or contract for deeds. You could also consider requiring mailing by first class mail and then require an affidavit of mailing to be available so that there is some degree of proof that the mailing actually occurred. Just a couple suggestions.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, my name is Terry Steenblock, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Individual Taxes at the Department of Revenue. And in answer to the question, we as you mentioned, we do mail it. We have an agreement with the post office as well. We get a file back from the post office if there's a change of address, or in the event something is not delivered, we get a file back from the post office as well. And then we work to locate a new address to send those to. And in some cases with the license revocation, we're serving those in person because of other things or activities that we're taking at that time. So I just wanted to share some of the ways we know that it has been delivered.
Ms. Steenblock, is this a method by which other Department of Revenue license notices are served?
Mr. Chair, we are unique in that there aren't other states have emulated us. So the states that do, there are a few that have this, and the states that do, this aligns with their practice, but there aren't many states that have a license revocation process.
How about other Department of Revenue actions?
Mr. Chair, this aligns with other Department of Revenue actions because, as Mr. Peterson mentioned, we have heard over and over again when we send things certified mail, the taxpayer does not pick it up, and when they find out about it is when we've taken a more enforced action such as a bank levy. So we're actually doing them a disservice when we send it certified mail.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I guess I'm coming in late on this conversation. But if we're talking about notifying the license holder of a revocation for an illegal of a license because they illegally engaged in selling unstamped or products that they haven't paid a sales tax on, I guess I'm not. It doesn't rise to the level of a concern that we go out of our way to make sure they know that they're going to lose their license for doing something that's been illegal, that is illegal. I think this is a perfectly reasonable way to notify, and I don't worry about raising it to a higher level. It's the way we notify. These are people that already know they're doing something that is not legal. So I don't think they should be surprised. Due process is what...
I have a question about Section 1, and I'm very disappointed that Senator Limmer hasn't raised this already.
Done.
What is the purpose of your purpose section?
I told them that certain people don't like purpose statements.
Mr. Chair.
Comments. Do we really need it?
Members of the committee, no.
Senator Limmer moves to delete section one.
Seconded.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Roll call.
Opposed. Motion
just for
thank you. This, we really don't like them unless there's some real important need to tell the court, you know, how to interpret things. I think they can figure this one out. All right. Any other conversations or discussions? Does anyone else in the room want to testify in connection with this bill? Senator Dzik?
If you're kind of done with questions, I have to ask one myself because I informed them of a certain word on here that, again, you all missed, and that is on line 7. I told them, make sure you have a definition for willful because they're going to ask what willful is. And so I'm extremely disappointed that you didn't.
You
they actually
know
have an answer. They have an answer.
That's not
Mr. Peterson,
Hall.
What does willfully mean?
Mr. Chair, Dzik. You know, the definition of willful goes back probably to, as I was researching this, and Senator Dzik said, you're going to have to ask this, 1933 U.S. Supreme Court case that actually goes back and says, you know, tax is different than everything else, and because it's so complicated. And I suspect the law has developed and it's really complicated for everything else now, too. But back in 1933, when the Minnesota legislature was bypassing the first income tax, the U.S. Supreme Court said there's something different about taxes, and this concept of willful got into the tax code, the federal tax code. Minnesota piggybacks on a lot of the concepts of federal tax law, and this concept of willful has been in the Minnesota tax laws for a long, long time. This provision that's in here now that talks about a felony for willfulness is already in Section 289A. It applies to the main taxes, income tax, sales tax, corporate taxes, and such. And last year, the Minnesota Court of Appeals affirmed a conviction under that other statute, and in doing so, they said what the difference between knowingly failing to file a tax return and knowingly filing a tax return to willfully avoid the payment of a tax. The taxpayer knows that they have failed to satisfy an obligation, but they don't have a purpose. They don't have an intent to actually defeat the tax by doing that. The willfulness is that they know they have this obligation and they are doing something that will, they believe that if they do it, it will successfully avoid the payment of the tax, or they actually are doing it because they want to be able to get away with paying the tax, both the day that they don't do it and trying to hide it from the commissioner. And the Court of Appeals has looked at it, and there was another case from 2 years ago. So in the tax arena, I know that this concept of willfulness really doesn't much exist in your world here, but right. In the
thank
little tax
you,
world,
there's.
Thank
Hall.
You.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ken,
thank you.
Mr. Is it Cummins?
Cummins,
yes. Can you tell us how much we expect revenue to come in through taxes that we're not getting right now because of the smuggling going on?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
Mr. Cummins,
it's a very difficult calculation to make, and you know we can go through some of the past experiences about what we've seen in terms of seizures in the state and count up how much money that is. We generally expect that there will be a slight uptick in the amount of voluntary compliance related to tobacco compliance, tobacco tax compliance due to this proposal. In terms of trying to put an exact figure on that, that's a very difficult calculation.
Is it going to be more than what we're appropriating, Mr. Chair?
We estimate that it will be. Mr. Chair. And that's something that we'll be talking about as we get to the Finance Committee.
Okay.
It won't be, Senator Hall, this is not going to be a much larger amount than what is appropriated, but we do believe that the revenue that will be gained through the fees as well as through the increase in a voluntary compliance will be larger than the appropriation outlined.
Okay, and for Mr. Turner, I guess I'm wondering, if this has a fiscal note of some sorts, and then did we figure that in a fiscal note when we increased the taxes on cigarettes, did we figure that this would be something that we would have to do eventually?
Senator Hall, this will go to finance is the next stop. FYI. Answer Mr. Turner if you know right now.
Real quickly, Mr. Chair, Senator Hall. This is a governor's change item in the budget. There is no fiscal note. The legislature takes for granted that the numbers have been run. As the change item shows, the revenues are roughly $2.1 million per year, new revenues. The expenditures for the 11 FTEs to implement the bill is after startup costs, roughly half of that, $1 million.
Thank you.
Senator Lemmer.
Mr. Chair, we could turn to page 7. On lines 14 as well as lines 11, there's a reference to two new felonies that are being proposed. We don't know what kind of felonies those are, so I'm assuming it's a default penalty, but would counsel tell us what default penalty might mean if there's no other reference?
Line are you on? We couldn't hear with the door opening.
Lines 11 and 14, page 7.
Mr. Backus. Mr. Chair, members, it would be a five-year felony, $10,000 fine.
On both?
That's correct.
Does anyone else wish to testify in connection with this bill? Come on forward.
Good luck.
Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you to Senator Dietzick for carrying this bill. My name is Molly Moylanen, and I work for Clearway, Minnesota. We're an organization dedicated to reducing tobacco's harm. I represent a coalition who support improved enforcement of tobacco tax policies in Minnesota. These include the Association for Non-Smokers Minnesota, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota, the American Cancer Society, Cancer Action Network, and many others. As you know, we worked with many of you in partnership to pass a significant tobacco tax on cigarettes and other tobacco products in 2013 to reduce youth smoking and drive down health care costs. And it's been very encouraging to see that the increase is working. We have already seen a dramatic drop in smoking, especially among youth and young adults. In addition to having high tobacco tax rate in Minnesota, we are again at the forefront and a national leader in that we tax e-cigarettes the same as other tobacco products. To maximize the health benefits of the tobacco tax and to create an even playing field for e-cigarettes and other tobacco products, compliance with the law is key. At the local level, one of the tools that has been critical to ensuring compliance is licensing. Local licensing authorities are required to conduct at least annual compliance checks to ensure compliance with age of sale laws. Local license fees cover the cost of these compliance checks and other administrative fees. Current laws requires all tobacco vendors to be licensed by the county or the city. Local units of government need to license vendors, or they have no leverage to enforce either the state or local laws. The measure proposed in this bill really complements what's happening at the local level. Currently, the state has no way to revoke a tobacco license when taxes have not been paid. The bill and the amendment provides this needed authority. The tobacco product landscape is changing, and this shows why we can't rest on our laurels. With the increase in popularity of e-cigarettes and their lack of federal regulation, Minnesota is facing new enforcement challenges. By helping to close the gaps in the current system, this bill is a step in the right direction, and we are pleased to support it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Moylan? Senator Lemmer.
Not for her, Mr. Chair, but just some general questions. Mr. Cummins, why do you think there's an increase in illegal cigarette smuggling?
Mr. Cummins.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as it relates to, we think that there's less cigarette smuggling going on. The presence of the stamp on the cigarette is a very powerful way to have the regulation of the market. As it relates to tobacco, it's very difficult to stamp that product, so it's unstamped. So as it relates to smuggling, there's many reasons why that would happen, but it primarily happens with the tobacco markets, Senator Lemmer.
One thing I just wanted, I was kind of, as I was looking at this bill, I kind of was reminded of conversations we had when we were considering imposing higher taxes on tobacco products, and we were told by law enforcement that illegal sales of tobacco products would be on the rise. And I think we've now arrived at that, which may raise the question of how far do we raise taxes on any commodity until we make it to the point that it's lucrative for criminal enterprise. That's all.
Policy discussion passed us. Now we have to deal with the current landscape, Senator Lemmer. Anyone else wish to testify in connection with this bill? No one here to testify against it? Any further discussion from members of the committee? Senator Dietzick, you have a motion?
I move that Senate File 1192 be sent to Parliament.
Senator Dietzick moves that Senate File 1192 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate Committee on Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Carls.
Thank you.
This is not it. Sorry, guys. We skipped over Senator Eakin's bill, and Senator Sieben's bill was laid on the table. Well, we have to go back to Senator Sieben's other bill as well. Senator Carlson's been in and out. Senator Eakin, are you prepared, ready to go forward? I'm not sure why you asked us to delay it. We're going to take up Senator Carlson first, but I just want to make sure if you're here, it's because you're prepared. Okay, I know we've had some people sitting here for a long time on Senator Sieben's bill. So let's get Senator Carlson's bill done. And I think maybe from there we'll go back. Senator Sieben's across the hall. Okay. Because the commissioner's been here all afternoon, Senator Eakin, I'm going to go to Senator Sieben's bill after Senator Carlson's is done, and then we'll take case. Senator Carlson.
Thank you,
Senate File 1473.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1473 is regarding the information, the data relating the hang cards for disability, people who have been certified as a disability with their name. We're attempting to address a simple conflict in the current law. Current law 169.345 and 169.346 require parking enforcement employees or agents of cities to enforce the misuse of disability parking certificates. 169.345 requires them to report any misuses, and 169.346 gives them the authority to issue citations for the certificate misuse. However, 13.69, which was the original hang tag or certificate law, does not give parking enforcement employees or agents access to the information needed to comply with this enforcement requirement. Problem was that in 2010, the city of Minneapolis moved its traffic and control division out of the Minneapolis Police Department and into the Regulatory Services Department. This bill adds parking enforcement employees and parking enforcement agents to the list of those who may access the status information of the disability parking certificate with the public, with the Department of Public Safety. The information is not medical data, and it's simply a yes or no qualification as to whether the certificate is legal, whether it's a counterfeit, or whether it's valid, is still valid and is not expired. With me to give a little bit more specific details on it is Ms. Clara Schmidt-Gonzalez. She's the Director of Traffic Control.
Ms. Schmidt-Gonzalez, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Clara Schmidt-Gonzalez, Deputy Director with Parking and Traffic Enforcement in the City of Minneapolis. Some recent changes to Chapter 13 of Minnesota statutes related to data privacy and some recent interpretations have resulted in us not being able to access disability permit data and therefore not being able to enforce misuse or abuse of the use of such permits since 2012. And our citations for this type of violation have gone down from 209 to simply 2 in recent years. Prior to that, our department had a long history of such enforcement, and this enforcement was much appreciated by those who legitimately use such permits. The change before you allows parking enforcement personnel of home rule or statutory cities and towns to access the data related to the status of permits, not including any medical data, for the specific enforcement purposes of 169.345 and 169.346. This change is supported by the Minneapolis Advisory Committee on People with Disabilities and by the State Council on Disability, and we ask for your support for this change.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Schmidt-Gonzalez? Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and members, we had some concern about what the statute meant where in on the bill, line 111, data on other data on holders of disability and whether there was exposure of other data. And what council did was put together an amendment, if you so choose. I have the A1 amendment, which restricts the data to only that data necessary for parking enforcement.
You guys have an A1 amendment? Sorry, we're going to distribute the A1 amendment. So this limits the access to the data. Is that only that data necessary for the enforcement purposes? Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, we need to be sure that we recognize that this is the data that connects the person to the hanging certificate. It does not affect the data that is license data, which this unit of government already has that access.
All right, everyone have the amendment? Any questions, members of the committee? Senator Hall.
To the amendment, we're changing it to data necessary for what data is necessary? I mean, you've got whether they've got a handicap sticker, they've got their name on there, is their car license on there, you know?
Ms. Senator Schmidt Gonzalez.
Mr. Chair, Senator, at this point, the certificate itself simply has a number on it, and then a month and a year. So what we would be asking for is the access to a file that would tell us whether that number is a valid certificate and whether it is in fact current or reported lost, stolen, or some other status that would be invalid. And so that's what we're looking for.
So, Mr. Chair, and to our testifier,
so what then do you do if it's invalid and you don't know who the owner is, but you know there's the vehicle? What's your next step then?
Ms. Schmidt Gonzalez.
Mr. Chair, Senator, our next step, once we confirm that the certificate is invalid, is that we know then that a crime has been committed. We tow the vehicle to the impound lot. We ticket the registered owner, or if another driver shows up with the owner to say it's my fault, I want to take responsibility, we ticket that person. But our violation is for misuse of the disability certificate.
Good. Thank you.
Any other questions about the amendment? Senator Hall moves adoption of the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Any other questions or discussion about the bill? Anyone else want to testify? Senator Hall moves.
I move Senate file 1473 as amended to
be recommended to pass and sent to
floor.
Floor. You have the jackpot, Senator Carlson.
Yeah,
all those
certainly
in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Senator Seba.
She's back.
Senate file 1658. Members, there is an A1 amendment in your packets.
A2 amendment, I believe.
This is human rights.
A3 amendment.
It's not in the packets?
No, it's just down.
I was kidding. It's not in your packets.
I was kidding.
It's coming.
It's marked up A2-1650.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A1 amendment, is that being just junk?
Recycle the A1 amendment.
Hey, thank you.
Who did this?
Look at this.
What's type?
Top notch. So are we going with A what?
What do we got?
A3 and a marked up A2.
A3 and a marked up A2. So your A2 should already be with your materials. That was adopted earlier. We're going to change it a little bit. Okay. And then if I could get a copy of the A3, that'd be helpful to probably offer you.
Okay.
Anyone mind? Thanks. All right, Ms. Pontius, do you want to, or Senator Seaman, whoever wants to describe the amendments?
Mr. Chair, I would recommend either Ms. Pontius or Commissioner Lindsay describe, but not me.
All right. Ms. Pontius.
Mr. Chairman, this, you may recall the discussion earlier about the conflict between this bill and Senator Johnson's bill that passed a few days ago. So what the A3 amendment does is basically it takes the language stylistically from Senator Johnson's bill. And there really were primarily just little wordsmithing changes. it does retain what is probably the main substantive part of Senator Sieben's bill, which is what you see on lines, the clause starting in line 3 about the local units of government. And that going down to line 5 through the grant. So that's the clause that's not in Senator Johnson's bill. But the rest of it is verbatim from Senator Johnson's bill. And then on the A2, which he adopted earlier, that I just marked up by hand, on lines 2 to 5, that's no longer necessary because that's part of the A3. And then there's just a little wordsmithing on the rest of it to make it consistent with the language that's involved. Try to add a few commas and make it a little more readable.
Okay. Does everyone understand the proposed amendments? Any questions or comments? Commissioner Lindsay, do you wish to add anything before we consider the amendments?
Sure, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I guess I do wish to, again, appreciate the effort of council bringing attention to the need to reconcile Senator Johnson's bill language and then working with my staff to make this change before you. I think that's all I want to say.
All right. Anyone else want to testify on the amendments? Senator Sharon, would you like to offer the A2 amendment?
I would.
All right, and she does. All those in favor of the A2 amendment as the amendment to what was previously passed as the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Those amendments are adopted. The A3 amendment. Senator Sharon offers the A3 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. All right. Now, to the bill. Is there any further discussion, questions? Senator Lemmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been a while since we had this earlier today. Senator Sieben, could you tell me, we didn't have a big discussion on the A3 amendment. And now that it's part of the bill, could you tell me what is this bill's purpose? What are we trying to do with the bill?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, the point of the A3 amendment was to clarify language that was also very similar to modifying these provisions of statute that were contained in Senator Johnson's bill. But the idea of the overall point of my legislation is that when that human rights certificates of compliance and equal pay certificates should be required for projects that use public bonding proceeds or public bonding dollars. So, for example, if a local unit of government gets a grant or a bonding grant from a general obligation bond from the state of Minnesota, then that local unit of government would need to get the certificate of compliance or for the human rights issues and the equal pay certificate from the contractors that are working on that particular project.
And are there, Mr. Chair, are there any examples of misuse or illegal activity or times that we can point at that would say that there's people out there doing things wrong or taking advantage of the programs that we've provided without verification?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, it's not a program that the state is providing. What the certificates of compliance are attempting to do is to help the local units of government, in this case, state affirmatively that they are paying the subcontractors or the contractors that are being used are paying women the same rate that they are paying men, for example, or that under the human rights certificate that the units of government or the entity receiving the grant
is attempting to meet the workforce goals for inclusion or diversity that is outlined in the human rights certificate legislation or statute that's already in place.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator
Sieben, on A3 amendment, there's a reference to it says local units of government that receive grants funded with general appropriation funds. Is there anywhere else in the bill that would make reference? I don't know if we grant funds through general appropriation bonds to private sector entities. Would your bill be focused on private entities as well as local local units of government?
Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, I'll defer to Commissioner Lindsay, but not that I'm.
Commissioner Lisman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lemon, the answer is no. It would not apply as it relates to private businesses.
All right.
Any further questions or discussion? Senator Sharon moves that Senate file 1658 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Pontius, especially.
Good work product.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Council, and thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you. Senator Eakin. Last bill of the day.
We usually don't pass those, do we?
We'll either be very tired or very squirrely.
Maybe a little of both, Mr. Chair.
Senate File 1471. Welcome, Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1471 is a bill dealing with nursing home receivership. It makes changes to increase consumer protection. The Department of Health does have the authority to obtain receivership authority over facilities when the life and safety of residents is threatened because of the actions or inactions of facility operators or owners. The Department of Health determines that it's necessary to undertake state receivership when it feels that it has or when it has concluded that the conditions on site are life-threatening and that time is of essence. The receiverships are court-ordered, and before the Department of Health can go to court, it must have an agreement with the managing agent who will be the actual day-to-day operator. This whole process from the internal decision to proceed with the receivership to obtaining the court order takes about 2 weeks. And as I said, time is of essence. So one of the things that this bill does is it shortens the time period, expedites it. Shortens the time frame from the judge or for the judge to issue an order authorizing the receivership from 5 days to 1 day in the current bill. It also requires that the Department of Health has to establish and maintain a list of qualified managing agent candidates so that there's a list available and ready to go. That too would shorten the time period. There's also minimum legal requirements for the managing agent candidates, such as there can be no conflict of interest with the facility that's in receivership. It clarifies that the owners must still pay mortgages, liens, and taxes owed during the receivership. It also states that for new operators post-receivership, they are not legally responsible for the state law violations occurring before they became the operators. And, Mr. Chair, there is one change that we would like to make, and it was based on some discussion between care providers, the nursing homes, and the Department of Health. That's in regard to on page 3, line 3.6. As I said, that it was shortening the time period from the court to issue a temporary order from 5 days to 1 day. We would like to make that 2 days instead of one. So, again, on line 3.6, strike 1 day and insert 2 days. We could add that in.
Any questions from members of the committee about the appropriateness of that amendment? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves adoption of that amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Senator Sharon, you're very active offering amendments in the last half an hour.
Sharp tonight.
Right on top of things.
Thank you.
Senator Eakin.
I just aims to move it along.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I do have Darcy Miner here, who's the director of the Health Regulation Division at the Department of Health, to answer any questions and to provide any testimony she would like.
Ms. Miner, did you need to say anything, or are you just available if we have questions?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Darcy Miner, the director of the Health Regulation Division, and I will answer any questions.
Good answer. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Senator Newman.
Only for Ms. Pontius.
Oh, page, Ms. Miner's weight worth it here, but apparently not.
Page 7, section 6 on the repealer. I'm sorry, the battery on my computer is going dead. What are we repealing?
What? Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Pontius.
I have to give you a flip the page on that.
That's why we have you.
That's it.
Thank you, Ms.
That's
Bonnie.
My legal advice.
Fabulous legal advice. That's right.
Yeah, not bad.
All right. We'll give Senator Newman a moment to read the repealer. These statutes that are made redundant or replaced by the bill, Ms. Miner.
Mr. Chairman, the voluntary receivership, what we're doing in the bill is to clarify that there would only be what we were calling state receiverships, and it would eliminate the category of voluntary receivership, and rather than leaving the title of involuntary receivership, we just call it a state receivership.
And how about the fees provision, 256B?
Mr. Chairman, this section is the DHS statute, but I believe that it also is redundant because of other language, but perhaps counsel could correct me if that's wrong.
Ms. Pontius, general practitioner.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's not a fiduciary question per se, and I do not know the answer.
All right. Well, this bill did come from HHS, so I'll assume it was dealt with in HHS because that's their statute.
That's it.
All right. Anyone else in the room wish to testify in connection with this bill? Seeing no rush to the testifiers' table. Any final closing remarks, Senator Eakin?
Mr. Chair, the bill would be referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Division is where we want to send it.
All right. So Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 1471 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. There you have it, Senator Eakin. Ms. Miner, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
So members, we are done with today's agenda. Thank you for all of your work. We will reconvene tomorrow morning, Friday, March 20 at 9 a.m. in our usual abode, room 15. So,
how long?
We will be out of here, the Capitol, no later than 5:30 because I have to be
somewhere.
Tomorrow night. Hopefully shorter than that, but I'm giving you an outside. I don't know. How many bills do we have?
I don't think it'll be that.
Eight.
Oh, yay, Emily.
Just eight? We can do more.
Ten bills. Okay.
Oh, we can do
ten bills is manageable.
Drones. Just put me in the chair.
All right. Should we start a pool? Should we start a pool to see what time people make
drones
the out?
Yeah, I'll take the very last time slot.
Oh, I'll adjourn the committee. We can turn off the tape now.
We call this frivolity. We don't.